stampeding forms that flung themselves at the Hyundai and flared around it. Phalanxes of eucalyptuses stood guard against descent, penetrated by the herded fog but seemingly impenetrable to all else. Having walked the land for years, Sanjay knew the architecture of earth, rock, and flora. To him, this wilderness wasn't wild, but a palace of elegant chambers and passageways. He steered between jams of rock, across a canted threshold of stone, onto a slope of rain-jeweled ribbon grass, and toward the trees, as if the wall they presented was as insubstantial as the fog that seethed between them.
Sanjay, no!
Tanuja warned as he maintained speed.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Jav!
She cried, an obscenity he had never before heard her use in any language. She braced herself for impact. At the last moment, he thought he'd angled toward the wrong point in the tree line, but then the unbroken rampart of forest was revealed to be an illusion. The trees to the left were older growth, 20 feet downhill from the younger specimens to the right. The distance differential made them appear the same size and age, and the abrupt drop in the land hid the truth that one long phalanx was in fact two. The Hyundai plunged. Sanjay swung the vehicle hard to the right. It didn't roll. He drove behind the younger stand of eucalyptus, which was a natural windbreak, 3 trees deep, rather than a full forest. He continued north along a narrow escarpment, trees to the right, a black void to the left where the land descended, more steeply now, 300 or 400 feet to the canyon floor. They'd had no option other than an off-road escape, but he knew that this escarpment narrowed until it terminated in an outfold of canyon wall. They needed to go down into less hospitable territory. Twin luminous globes appeared behind them, haloed in the mist, shimmering witchily in the rain. Nothing of their source revealed, like some otherworldly visitation. But of course, they were the headlights of the Range Rover. Sanjay wheeled the Hyundai off the ridgeline, into the void. 9. Gaining Sarah Holdsteck's trust had taken Jane Hawk much longer than she would require to get answers to the few essential questions that she had come there to ask. She popped a pill with her coffee. Sarah raised her eyebrows. "Acid reducer," Jane explained. "Taken with black coffee. Coffee doesn't reflux on me. The mess the world's in, the arrogant elitists who screwed it up, who believe in nothing but power, like your ex-husband, that's the acid, why I need this. You have an extra one of those?" Jane shook a tablet from the bottle and passed it across the table. "So Simon occupies the house you used to own." Sarah swallowed the pill. "I hear he has a live-in hottie." "I know about the hottie, but there are some things about the house I couldn't get from research. I need you to tell me."
"Anything. Whatever. But maybe it's time I knew your name."
"Elizabeth Bennett," Jane lied.
"Like in Pride and Prejudice?
Is it?
Do you sometimes go as Elizabeth Darcy?"
Jane smiled. "Not that I recall." "All right, Lizzie. What do you want to know about the house?" A few minutes later, Jane changed the subject. "I also need some info about certain of his personal habits." When a sudden acceleration of wind drove raindrops against the house with the hard snap of a nail gun barrage, Sarah didn't startle as before or glance at the blinded windows. In a quiet, steady voice, she spoke dispassionately about Simon Yegg, apparently now convinced there was a chance that some justice would be settled upon him. Jane's last item concerned family. "You ever meet his brother?"
"Simon has a brother?"
"A half-brother. Same mother, different fathers."
"His dad died when Simon was 8. His mom 6 years later."
"No. She divorced the father. He later died in a fire. Mother's not dead."
"Damn. Did the man never say a word of truth?"
"His tongue's not made for it. You know a Booth Hendrickson?"
Never heard of him. He's the half-brother. Born in Florida. Raised in Nevada, California. Tall, salt-and-pepper hair, pale green eyes. Talks like he's Boston society. $5,000 suits. Rings no bell. He's very high up in the Department of Justice, only a couple rungs below the Attorney General. Through a network of associates, he seems to have a lot of power in other agencies. Sarah digested that revelation. Her souring expression suggested that she might be glad to have taken the pill Jane had given her. Other agencies? Like the IRS? Not just the IRS. He's a unique cross-agency player. What? He and Simon ruin naive women and split the proceeds? I doubt Hendrickson wants a dime. He does it for his brother. How touching. They have different last names. They don't advertise their relationship. Hendrickson has much bigger interests of his own that he wouldn't want compromised by Simon, but they're close, and I was able to link them. You said you're after Simon because of who he hangs with. You mean Hendrickson? Yeah. I'm going to get at Hendrickson through Simon. After Hendrickson? Others just as corrupt as those two. Jane got to her feet and picked up the heckler and holstered it. It'll be best for you if you never tell anyone about me or what we discussed. Who would I tell? I don't trust anyone anymore. That'll change if you let it. You're smarter now about who might be rotten. Just remember the pistol rig, a new security code. Code tonight. The rig tomorrow. I won't be going to Paris either, or Yosemite. Jane went to the back door that led to a patio. Behind her, Sarah said, "Oh my God." Jane turned. She saw in the woman's face something that was disconcertingly like awe. I know who you are. Black hair, not blonde. Black eyes, not blue. But it's you. I'm nobody. Sarah didn't say that Jane, once a decorated FBI agent, was now at the top of the Bureau's most wanted list, the object of a media frenzy. She pointed to the banner headline on the Los Angeles Times. There's no truth in the news, is there? Not about you. Not about anything. We're living in a world of lies. There's always truth, Sarah. Under an ocean of deceit, there's truth just waiting. The woman's weariness gave way to an earnest look, to an air of edgy enthusiasm that troubled Jane. Whatever they've done, you're taking it to them. Whatever they're hiding, you're digging it up. She rose from her chair. People. Some people, anyway, sense we're being manipulated about what to think of you, but we don't know why they want you to be so hated. I wish I had what you have, could do what you're doing. I'm nobody, Jane repeated, though not in the interest of denying her identity. I could be dead tomorrow, if not tonight. You won't be, though. Not you. The fervor in the woman's voice, a shining something in her eyes, chilled Jane for reasons she could not entirely understand. Yes, me, she said. Dead sooner than later, or something worse than dead. To discourage a response, she stepped outside with her last word and closed the door. She crossed the concrete patio, hurried alongside the house and into the street, toward the car that she'd parked a block and a half away. The singular chill persisted in her bones, colder than the late March rain. She cast a shadow under the street lamps, which was good. The sharp wind stung her face, and the blown rain blurred her vision, which was also good. The darkness, that of the lowering storm clouds, and especially that of the star-shot sky fixed eternal above the storm, made her feel small and fragile, which was both good and right. 10. They switchbacked down the canyon slope at precarious angles more felt than seen, in a mist that curdled and became less animate as the wind diminished with their altitude, and as the walls of the declivity drew closer on both sides. The special off-road tires churned through sodden weeds and sandy mud, spun and slid sideways on wet-layered shale that splintered and sluiced out from under the Santa Fe Sport. Storm runoff followed ancient channels, foaming torrents that, in the crossing, surged against the wheels, as though to tip the Hyundai out of Sanjay's control and roll it into ruin. Where there was no shale or stone of any kind, he feared that the hundreds of feet of compacted soil, saturated by hours of relentless rain, would begin to move under their vehicle like an immense beast from 1,000 millennia in the past, avalanching them into the lower darkness and burying them there beyond all possibility of escape or rescue. Despite the focus demanded of him by the terrain and weather, from time to time Sanjay glanced upslope, or Tanuja encouraged him to do so, and always, above them, finding its way toward them, was the Range Rover, with its sinister passengers. If their pursuers were not drawing steadily closer, neither were they falling much behind. As he could see them by the lights that guided them, so the lights of the Hyundai encouraged their pursuit. When the gauntlet of trees and brush and mud and rushing water had been navigated, they arrived at the canyon's bottom, where thousands of storm spates converged to form a temporary brown river surging and tossing southward. Sanjay switched off the headlights before turning in the same direction that the river raced.
"Maybe they'll think we went north," he said.
"They won't," Tanuja disagreed, although she was not by nature a pessimist. "Without headlights, we'll have to go slower. They'll catch us sooner."
"I don't intend to go slower, Tani," he assured her.
In the formation of the river, the descending water had washed debris from its banks. Even objects as large as rotting sections of long-fallen trees, which tumbled and wallowed along in the filthy currents. Furthermore, over many thousands of years and countless storms, the land here had been smoothed until the banks, short of flood tide, were almost as navigable as causeways. Although the Hyundai could no longer be seen by those farther up the canyon wall, Sanjay was at first all but blind, the way ahead obscure. The brown water was dimly visible on their right because of its agitation and its freight of pale flotsam, but also because its churning generated lush garlands of vaguely phosphorescent foam that flowered upon it and gave definition to its sinuous form.
"We'll leave tire tracks in the soft earth," Sanjay said, "but in this rain, those ought to wash away in a minute or two. And where there's scree instead of mud, we won't leave tracks at all. They'll have to go slower than they want, looking for where we might have turned away from the river and gone uphill again."
"Suddenly you've got a chuska for danger," Tanuja said.
"I've got no taste for it at all," he objected, "but I sure am obsessed with staying alive."
11. Waiting for the heater to bake the chill out of her bones, Jane Hawk sat behind the wheel of her Ford Explorer Sport, staring at a nightscape distorted by rain shimmering down the windshield. Through that fluid lens, the street lamps appeared to quiver, receding like great scaffold-mounted torches along some shadowy road that led to death and onward to damnation. She had purchased her current vehicle from an all-cash black market dealer who worked out of a series of barns on a former horse ranch near Nogales, Arizona. The Explorer Sport had been stolen in the United States and reworked in Mexico, where, among other improvements, it had been given a purpose-built 825-horsepower 502 Chevy engine. If you had to go on the run, hunted by law enforcement and national security agencies at the federal, state, and local level, it paid to have been an FBI agent who had learned how various criminal enterprises operated and where to find them. At Jane's request, the navigation system had been stripped from the Explorer. If those searching for her got a lead on the vehicle, a GPS would give them her location with such specificity, mile by mile, that they could take her as elegantly as a bird of prey snatching a field mouse from a meadow. To avoid carrying other locators, she had no smartphone and no computer.
The hot air streaming from the dashboard vents warmed her but failed to alleviate the deeper chill, which wasn't physical. It had gripped her when Sarah Holdsteck regarded her with fervent admiration, if not even reverence. Jane didn't want to be anybody's hero. She had undertaken this fight for two selfish reasons: to restore her husband's reputation, because Nick had not committed suicide as the evidence indicated, and to save the life of her only child, 5-year-old Travis, who'd been threatened when her investigation of Nick's death led to the discovery of a conspiracy in some of the highest offices of government and industry. The roots of that cabal spread day by day through a nation of people unaware of their extreme peril. She had accepted that she might die during this endeavor. Even if she exposed and destroyed the conspiracy, she'd almost certainly afterward be murdered as a matter of revenge. Her enemies were people of great power and wealth, unaccustomed to defeat, and they would not endure it with grace. Travis was hidden away with friends, where he wasn't likely to be found. Were she to be killed, he would be raised with love and proper guidance. Her chances of survival, slim as they were, depended on staying tightly focused, on keeping her purpose narrow and her motivation personal, proceeding with confidence tempered by humility. Although the future of freedom hung in the balance, she was no Joan of Arc and didn't want to be weighed down by a grand obligation like the one that had inspired the Maid of Orléans, at the insistence of adoring crowds to put on armor and pick up a sword. Charismatic crusaders of that kind were doomed, even in triumph, destroyed by exalted ambition if not by pride. And what Jane's enemies could do to her, if they brought her down, would be far worse than being burned alive at the stake. She turned on the windshield wipers and drove away from the curb. A difficult task awaited her, and time was running out. 12. The dreary rain, like a forewarning of despair to come, the claustrophobic closed coffin darkness of the night, the half-seen python-muscled river in its serpentine flow to the right of them, like some pagan god of fate whose forward slithery rush compelled them to follow, heedless of all consequences. Tanuja Shukla made no claim to psychic powers. The future was as unknown to her as to anyone. But as they neared the southern end of the canyon, where the surging cataracts would flood between the piers of a bridge and under the county road, the exhilaration of their apparent escape gave way to a vague presentiment of disaster. Sanjay's strategy seemed to have worked. The imprudent speed with which he'd driven headlong into the gloom had brought them a few rocky moments when the ground under the Hyundai had become briefly treacherous, when they were startled by massive entanglements of tumbleweed and other loose brush, as big as the SUV itself, that blew down from higher ground and against the vehicle with a screech and clatter as of some beast born of myth and mist. But for several minutes now, the headlights of the Range Rover had not cleaved the night and rain behind them. Their pursuers evidently had turned away from the river to follow a false trail, or had fallen so far behind that turnings in the land concealed them. Yet, as Sanjay drove out of the mouth of the canyon, up a slope of gravel, onto the county road, and turned right onto the bridge, Tanuja braced herself for a crisis. It arrived at once in the form of a big Chevrolet crew cab pickup jacked on outsized tires. They were headed west, and the truck came from that direction. They had every reason to expect that it would cruise past them, driven by someone as innocent as they were. Instead, it angled to a stop on the bridge approach. The back doors on both sides were flung open, and men jumped out into the rain. There was no turning back into the canyon, nor could they do a 360, because less than 2 miles to the east lay the dead end and the house that they had so recently fled. If Sanjay had slowed in the face of this emerging threat, they would have been lost. But even as the pickup skidded to a stop and the doors began to open, he accelerated. The Santa Fe Sport shot forward, and for one mad instant, Tanuja thought her brother meant to ram the Chevy head-on. The man who jumped down from the starboard side of the truck held a shotgun in his right hand. He looked surprised to see their Hyundai rocketing toward him, his face pale and wide eyes glittering with reflections of their headlights. He wasn't fast enough to bring up the shotgun in a two-hand grip and wasn't smart enough to fling himself out of harm's way. The Hyundai clipped the open door, and the door checked the gunman hard, knocking him off his feet and backward as they careened past.
"Holy shit!" Tanuja declared on impact.
The Chevy blocked too much of the roadway, and Sanjay could not get past it on the pavement. He steered down a graveled slope, the angle of descent seeming even more severe than it was because they had lost one headlight in the collision, the single remaining beam lending a cockeyed aspect to all that lay before them. He fought the steering wheel as the back end of the Hyundai slid clockwise. With the vehicle horizontal to the shoulder of the highway above them, at a scary slant that encouraged Tanuja to brace herself in expectation of a roll, Sanjay drove west across the face of the incline, well past the pickup, perhaps out of shotgun range, before angling uphill and returning to the blacktop. Tanuja looked at the starboard mirror as her brother glanced at the rear view. Speaking over each other, she said, "Here they come! Here they come!" as he said, "We can outrun a freaking crew cab pickup!"
"They're just letting that guy lie there on the road," she said. "Maybe he's dead."
"He's not dead," Sanjay said.
"The door hit him hard."
"Not that hard."
"I don't care if he's dead. He was going to shoot us."
"Who are these crazy bastards?"
"Rakshasa,"
Tanuja said, referring to a race of demons from Hindu mythology, an element of fantasy she had used in a novelette.
"Hoods, goons, torpedoes," Sanjay said. "But working for who? Doing what? Why us?
And how the hell did they know where we'd come out of the canyon?"
Bullets of rain fragmented off the windshield as the Santa Fe Sport topped 90 miles per hour and, even with all-wheel drive, seemed to risk hydroplaning off the rain-swept blacktop. They were still in a rural area, but the road undulated and curved through a miles-long downgrade toward the densely populated lowlands of Orange County. The crew cab pickup had ceased falling farther behind, but wasn't gaining either, when in the distance a pulsing light quickened out of the dark and mist, the source hidden beyond the far fall of the highway. At first, as eerie as an alien close encounter a la Spielberg. White and red, red and blue. White and red.
"Hey, cops!" Sanjay said. "We're okay, Tani! It's the cops!"
"Lincoln Crossley's the cops. A sheriff's deputy, same thing," said Tanuja,
and she remembered Link temporarily rendered sightless by insecticide and firing his gun blindly, even though he'd been as likely to hit his two companions as to kill either her or Sanjay. She groaned as a patrol car topped the distant rise, the light bar on its roof flaring brighter. The siren could now be heard, even over the roar of rain and engine.
"We are so screwed!"
"We aren't screwed," Sanjay disagreed.
"We are so screwed!"
"What do you know? You write hopeful fantasy, magic realism, whatever. I'm the noir guy, and I say we're not screwed."
"Chodu," she said.
"We are not Chodu."
"We are so Chodu,"
she insisted, as the siren swelled louder. 13. The storm relented from a downpour to a fitful drizzle by the time Jane parked around the corner and almost two blocks from her destination in the city of Orange. She walked from there, carrying a zippered tote bag. If the authorities ever made a connection between her and the metallic gray Explorer, a vehicle description would be put on the National Crime Information Center website with an alert to every law enforcement agency in the nation. Thereafter, she would be in constant jeopardy while driving it. She would need 2 or 3 days to get new license plates and a DMV registration from her current source for forged documents in Reseda, north of Los Angeles. It might be safer to abandon the SUV than to use it during the interim between an NCIC listing and the receipt of new plates and documents. Better, instead, to be discreet, to park out of any line of sight from the place she intended to visit. The guy she needed to see wasn't part of the conspiracy against which she'd set herself. She didn't expect him to betray her,
But like snakes molting out of their old skins, people so often shed her expectations of them that she had learned to be ready for anything. The building was as she remembered it, flanked by parking lots, presenting an imposing two-story Southern Classic Revival face of white-painted brick with raised portico, balustrade, and tapered columns. At 9 o'clock, cars stood in both parking lots. Avoiding the front entrance, she went around the west side of the establishment, where the grand facade gave way to the stucco so prevalent in Southern California that it suggested the primary goals of local architecture must be impermanence and ease of eventual demolition. At the back of the property was a wide detached garage with four roll-ups. Between the structures lay a motor courtyard. The main building featured an ordinary back entrance, but also a pair of sliding doors, behind which lay a freight elevator that was accessible only with a code entered in a keypad. She tried the door at the stoop, and found that she didn't need her lock-release gun. She stepped into a vestibule. A door directly ahead of her would open to a ground-floor hallway, where there would be people whom she didn't want to encounter. She tried the door on the left. Stairs led to the second floor. Behind the door on the right were stairs to the basement. She descended quickly. She came into a long corridor. A series of flush-set, 18-inch diameter frosted glass lenses shed a cold white light with a faint blue tint. The white walls were of a smooth, glossy laminate. Shiny gray vinyl served as flooring and baseboard, curving up to meet the walls. The space had a science fiction-y feel, as if she'd entered a time tunnel or an interstellar vessel. The freight elevator access to this level was on her right. She opened the door across the hall from the elevator, switched on the lights, saw a dead man, and went into that room. 14. As in a vivid but incomprehensible nightmare, the relentless pursuers came from behind them like a demonic posse with a death warrant, and police raced head-on toward them, the modulated siren shrilling. The land was still lonely and forbidding on both sides of the highway. The rain abruptly diminished as though a long drum roll had ended and the pending event to which it called attention would now occur. Sanjay respected the police and prided himself on remaining calm in difficult situations, but 25 years of experience had not prepared him for a night when known reality dropped out from under him as if it had been a trapdoor. Although it wasn't like him to rely on intuition rather than reason, he sensed that the insanity would only escalate from here. "Hold on," he warned Tanuja, as in the headlights, wet pavement glistened toward a crossroads. He pumped the brakes, made a hard right turn onto the new two-lane, nearly spun out, oriented the Hyundai, and accelerated. "What are we doing?" his sister asked. "I don't know." "Where are we going?"
"I'll know it when I see it."
"Will I know it when you see it?"
"Someplace we can get off the road, out of sight."
The blacktop wove through low hills and vales of ancient live oaks, immense and spreading, dark and dripping. Numerous curves, in conjunction with the trees, repeatedly screened their SUV from those in pursuit of them. Although Sanjay knew this back road well, he couldn't think of a bolt hole anywhere along its course. He was a guy who could focus as tightly as a laser, but he was first to admit he was a poor multitasker. He saw no need to chew gum and play basketball at the same time. He didn't even like basketball. He could pilot the Santa Fe Sport at high speed along wet pavement through treacherous curves with confidence, monitoring pursuers in the rear view and side mirrors. But an answer to the question, where next, eluded him. As always, Tanuja was a critical component in the two-piece puzzle that was the Shukla twins. She said, "We're coming up on Honeydale Stables. That's the place."
"That's the place," he agreed.
And here came the turnoff to their right, a single-lane driveway of cracked and potholed blacktop lined with oaks, bisecting a once-rich meadow gone to weeds, flanked by ranch fencing, collapsed in places by the work of termites, rot, and dry rot. Sanjay hung a right, killed the headlights.
He let their speed fall without using the brakes and avoided revealing their position with a red flush of taillights in case their pursuers might be closer than he believed they were. After about 30 yards, the private lane descended, and they were beyond view of the highway behind them, coasting into a valley that lay in a moonless, starless murk. The dilapidated fencing and colonnade of oaks guided them in the gloom, and the wild grass to both sides was not as dark as the pavement. They passed near the ruins of the once great house, in which the owners had perished in a fire 3 years earlier, a rubble of broken masonry and infallen timbers. 2 stone fireplaces with chimneys stood largely unscathed, oddly threatening in the night, like shrines to a primitive god that had slaughtered his own idolaters. Wind had been at work on the night of the fire. Flames jumped the extensive stables, and more than half were destroyed. The owners' breeding horses and the horses of others who'd paid to board their mounts at Honeydale were saved by the ranch manager, but the business died with its owners. After a contentious battle between heirs, the estate was eventually settled, but though the property had been on the market for a year, it hadn't yet sold. Sanjay drove behind one of the intact stables and parked and switched off the engine.
When they realize they've lost us, they won't backtrack to look. They'll figure we're long gone.
Tanuja rolled down her window. The rain had stopped. The wind had died. Cool night air brought with it a faint scent of char that the recent downpour had stirred from a half-collapsed stable nearby. But she heard neither a siren in the distance, nor the growl of engines.
Who'll believe us, Sanjay?
Not the sheriff. Something's corrupt there.
Referring to their parents, Tanuja said,
That's why dear Bap and Mai left India. So much corruption there. Why they brought us here so long ago. I still miss them, every day.
Sanjay agreed.
I always will.
The world lay in eclipse under the shrouded sky, and a palpable night tide seemed to pour through the open window, pooling thickly in the Hyundai. Sanjay felt strangely as if he were breathing both air and darkness, but exhaling only air.
Maybe the sheriff isn't rotten, Tanuja said. Just some of his deputies.
Or maybe he is rotten.
Most cities in the county have their own police.
But we don't live in one of those cities.
Well, we have to go to somebody.
Although Sanjay had not started the SUV, although neither he nor his sister had touched any control, the computer screen in the dashboard brightened, startling them. The navigation system became active. A map appeared. It featured a thick serpentine line labeled with the route number of the county road they had recently departed. Leading off the thick line, a thinner one wasn't labeled, although it could be nothing but the private driveway leading to Honeydale Stables. On the map, a red indicator blinked at the end of the driveway and to one side of it, where the Hyundai currently stood.
What's happening? Tanuja asked.
Sanjay threw open the driver's door and got out. He took a few steps forward to stand by the front bumper, listening to a stillness disturbed only by the arrhythmic ticking of the cooling engine, the dripping rainwater from saturated trees, and the occasional haunting question of an owl. As his sister exited the passenger door, Sanjay looked up at the sky, wondering, if someone knew the registration number of this vehicle and therefore was able to obtain the unique signal that its locator broadcast as part of its navigation system, could that someone find them? Did the vehicle's transponder continue to transmit even when the engine was off? Could a satellite serving their navigation system see them by that transmission? And could their GPS be switched on remotely to taunt them? He didn't know the answers. But the glowing screen in the dashboard seemed to say, You can't hide. He heard an engine in the distance. More than one. Tanuja looked at him across the hood of the SUV.
Sanjay?
As the engine noise grew louder, he hurried around the front of the Hyundai and grabbed his sister's hand.
Run!
15. The cool air carried on it an astringent chemical odor, and under that a fainter and less pleasant organic smell, on which Jane chose not to dwell. A slightly tilted stainless steel table with blood gutters had been used and methodically scrubbed clean. It stood empty now, as was the clear plastic collection reservoir under it. The decedent had been transferred to a second steel slab, this one without gutters, where he lay naked under a white shroud that exposed only his neck and head, and one arm that had slipped out from under the sheet and hung off the table. The hard, pitiless light rendered every enlarged pore as a crater, every wrinkle as a crevasse, so that his pale face had the texture and contours of a tract of desert tortured by heat, eroding wind, and tectonic forces. He would look much better in the morning, after the aesthetician had painted a semblance of life and an illusion of sleep over his grim features. Attached to the foot of the table was a file holder. She found a photograph of the deceased, as he had been when alive and healthy, a guide for the aesthetician. His name was on the back of the photo, Kenneth Eugene Conklin. She returned the file to the holder and placed a call with her disposable phone. In a viewing room upstairs in the funeral home, the proprietor answered.
Gilberto Mendez.
You once said you'd die for my husband if it came to that. No need to die, he beat you to it. But I could use a little help.
My God! Where are you?
Keeping company with Kenneth Conklin.
I don't believe this.
I'd put him on the line to vouch for me, but Ken's in a funk.
I'll be right there.
When Gilberto came through the door a minute later, dressed in a black suit and white shirt and black tie, he looked 20 pounds heavier than he'd been 2 years earlier, but still in good shape. He had a round, brown, pleasant face. His wife, Carmela, called it a gingerbread man's face. At 36, with receding hair, he'd begun to resemble the father from whom he'd inherited the business. Closing the door behind him, referring to Jane's jet-black hair and dark eyes, he said,
"You aren't you at all."
"It's just a wig, colored contacts, and attitude."
"Well, you've always had attitude."
He came to the farther side of the table, the dead man between them, and Jane said, "How are you doing, Gilberto?"
"Happier than I deserve to be."
"Makes me feel good just to hear that."
"We're having our fourth baby in June."
"Another girl?"
"A boy. God help him, with three older sisters."
"Like having three guardian angels."
"Maybe you're right."
Jane indicated the graven face of the man on the table. "At your dad's funeral 2 years ago, you said you were going to sell the business." When Gilberto smiled, he looked boyish, sweet. Even then, his eyes were the saddest Jane had ever seen.
"I joined the Marines to escape this," Gilberto said. "But the way it turned out, this work is a calling, not just a business. My dad said what it's about, above all else, is preserving the dignity of the dead, about not letting death rob them of it. That didn't make sense to me then. After I'd been to war, it did."
With tenderness, as if he were a nurse and the decedent a sick friend, he lifted the uncovered arm onto the table and pulled the shroud over it. He said,
"Nick never would have killed himself."
"He didn't."
"So this mess you're in, it's because you want the truth?"
"I've learned the truth about Nick. It's way beyond that now."
"The things they say about you on the news. Murder, selling national secrets, treason. No one who knows you would believe it."
"There's not much news in the news anymore. The lies they tell don't leave a lot of time for the facts about anything."
"Whose rocks did you overturn?"
She said. "Some of them are in government, some in private industry. They play a lot of the media like so many harmonicas." From the moment Gilberto had mentioned Carmela's pregnancy,
Jane had not been able to stop thinking about the wife, the three young daughters, and the boy waiting to be born. She said, "You've got so many responsibilities. I never should have come here. I better go." In a quiet voice, almost a murmur, suited to conversation with grieving loved ones in the viewing rooms on the main floor, he said, "How's your boy? How's Travis?" After a silence, she said, "He's struggling with the loss of Nick. But he's safe, hidden away with people who care about him."
"It's necessary to hide him, is it?
To stop me from investigating all this? They threatened to kill him. But they'll never get their hands on him. Never." When Jane picked up her tote bag to leave, Gilberto said,
"Why do you think Semper Fi doesn't mean anything to me anymore?"
"That's not what I think, Gilberto."
"Always faithful means always faithful, not just when it's convenient."
"Family first," she said. "Be faithful to your family."
"Nick was family. Like a brother. I wouldn't be here today if not for him. Makes you family too. Put down the tote. Respect me enough to tell me what you need from me. If it's too damn crazy, if it's jumping off a cliff, I'll say no."
She did not put down the tote bag. "I was going to ask you to pose as a chauffeur and drive a car."
"What else?"
"We'd be kidnapping this creep who works in the Department of Justice. My only remaining lead. He surfaced in the attack that killed the governor of Minnesota last week. I learned he's coming here when I backdoored the computer of his brother's limo company. He has information I'm going to have to break him to get, but I don't need you for that. You pick him up as if you're his assigned chauffeur, you drive him to me, you leave. That's it. If all goes well. Which, maybe it won't." He said,
"I'm a good driver. Never had a ticket."
"Kidnapping, Gilberto. They put you away for a long time."
"I'll just be driving. Playing a chauffeur. A piece of cake. Part of what I already do is be a chauffeur. I drive the hearse."
16. The California live oaks didn't grow close enough together to constitute a forest, but their crowns were of such immense diameter that across the vale and up a long slope, the figuration of their massive limbs arched over Tanuja and Sanjay like the vaulted ceiling of some elaborate nature-built cathedral in which the god Pan might come upon them, goat-legged and horned, playing his panpipes. But as they hurried away from Honeydale Stables, the closest thing to music was the singing of countless tree frogs that, in Tanuja's estimation, was ominous as never before. Such frogs always celebrated following a rainstorm, but they were acutely aware of intruders in their realm and fell silent during the passage of any human being. This chorus, an almost frenzied jubilation and not once interrupted, seemed to suggest that nature and her creatures knew that the Shukla twins were so soon to be dead that they were already hardly more than spirits and of no concern. The blessing of a writer's imagination was also a curse. With only wild grass and no deep brush to hamper them, on terrain presenting no foot-twisting fissures, they were restrained from a flat-out run only by the darkness and the fear of falling off an unseen edge. They reached the top of the ridge in good time and paused and looked back to the south, high enough to see over the trees. For a long moment, gasping for breath, they stared at two sets of headlights in the distance, neither pair of beams currently on the move, both focused on what must have been the Hyundai Santa Fe Sport that they had abandoned.
"Who are they?" she wondered.
"Not just sheriff's deputies. Someone bigger wants us."
"Bigger who? Wants us for what?"
"Damn if I know, Tanny, but we've got to keep moving."
Together, they turned from the southern vista. North-northeast, beyond another ridge, the darkness relented to an eerie light. In fact, three conjoined and distorted bubbles of light. One blue, one red,
One yellow. The blue like a gas flame, but constant in shade and brightness. The red not reminiscent of fire, but intense and darkish. And steady, like the ruby color of a lit glass cup on a votive candle rack. A canted brim of canary yellow, as if the blue and red were born on it like the twin crowns of a tipped hat. For a moment, it seemed to Tanuja that she was being drawn through this extraordinary and fearsome night towards some ultimate mystery and revelation, as might be a mystified character in one of the stories in her preferred genre of magic realism. But then, she realized from where the lights arose. She said, "It's neon glow from Coogan's Crossroads." The Crossroads was a restaurant, but less a restaurant than a tavern, and less a tavern than a tradition, the iconic gathering place to which the residents of the smattering of tiny communities in the remote East County canyons were drawn for companionship, especially on weekend nights like this.
"Probably half a mile," Sanjay said.
"We can get help there."
"Maybe," Sanjay said. "Maybe."
"There's sure to be at least a couple people we know."
"We knew Lincoln Crossley, or thought we did."
"The whole world can't have been corrupted, Sanjay. Come on!"
With the threat of their pursuers no longer immediate, they descended the ridge, angling north-northeast toward the neon aurora, adopting a less reckless pace overland now that they had a place to go and the hope of help. The clouds were slowly unraveling. Through the ragged rents and thinning veils came a suggestion of moonlight. The only thing that could go wrong now, or so it seemed, was for one of them to stumble in the gloom and fall and break a leg. Sanjay held Tanuja's left arm as together they proceeded with caution. 17. Maybe they kept the dead man between them because Jane still had second thoughts about involving this father of four in such a dangerous enterprise, and because Gilberto, for all his talk of Semper Fi and a debt owed to Nick, had doubts of his own. Solemn and silent on the table, the decedent was a barrier to impetuous action, a reminder that they might die in the course of a kidnapping. Jane's love for Nick was so intense that his death had not diminished it, and though Gilberto's gratitude and admiration were less piercing emotions, Jane's late husband served as a touchstone by which they both could test their commitment to what was good and true in a world of darkness and lies. But a touchstone had value only if they acted with reason, from a sense of duty, rather than because sentimentality overtook them. Jane knew, perhaps so did Gilberto, that a touch, a hug, even a handshake in the early minutes of this reunion could twist honest sentiment into sentimentalism, inciting him to make a fateful decision on the wrong grounds. "I appreciate you'd do this just for me," she said, "just for Nick. But if they discover you helped me, they won't care that all you did was drive. They'll take you out. You need to understand what they've done, what they want to do, how much they have to lose." She looked at the dead man's face, so eggshell white after his embalming, lips fixed as if they had never formed a smile, eyelids paper thin, as though half worn away by all the distressing sights against which, in life, they'd been closed. Nick had been cremated. She preferred fire, too, if, after her death, a body could be found. "These bastards, this conspiracy, cabal, whatever you want to call it, they have a computer model. It identifies people likely to steer civilization in the wrong direction, people in the arts, journalism, academia, science, politics, military." Gilberto frowned.
"Wrong direction? How does a computer decide what's the wrong direction for civilization?"
"It doesn't. They decided when they designed the damn computer model. All it does is identify targets. They say, just erase enough carefully selected people, those likely to achieve positions to influence others with wrong ideas, then, over time, we'll have utopia. But it's not about utopia.
It's all about power. Absolute power.
Gilberto had come back from war with an enduring sadness, from which was born a gentleness and a desire to avoid all conflict. But anger enfolded the gentleness now, and his mouth was set tight when he said,
"Just erase. Erase. Always the nice words for murder."
Joseph Stalin reportedly said, "A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic." You have a problem with that?
They're gonna kill a million?
Eventually more. 210,000 per generation in the U.S. So 8,400 a year.
They told you this?
One of them did. You'll have to take my word for it. He's not available to confirm it. I killed him. In self-defense. Although he'd been to war, Gilberto was shaken. War half a world away was different from battles in the streets of his own country. He put his hands on the steel table and leaned into it for support. Jane said, "The people they kill are on something called the Hamlet list. Once they identify the targets, they go after them when they're most vulnerable, when they're away from home at a conference or traveling alone, and can be drugged, sedated, one way or another."
Sedated?
They don't want it to look like murder. They sedate them and program them to commit suicide. Nick was on their Hamlet list. He cut his throat with his Marine Corps knife, his K-bar, sliced so deep that he severed a carotid artery. Gilberto stared at her for a long moment, as if to determine what brand of crazy she had embraced.
Program them?
Life is sci-fi these days, Gilberto. And it's not a feel-good family movie. You know about nanotechnology?
Microscopic things. Maybe machines so small they're invisible. Something like that.
In this case, constructs made from a few molecules, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, suspended in a serum, injected into the bloodstream. They're braintropic. Once they pass through the capillary walls into brain tissue, they self-assemble into a larger network, a web-like control mechanism. Within hours, total control is effected. The subject doesn't know anything's happened. He seems himself. No one sees anything different about him. But days later, weeks, whenever, he gets a command to commit suicide and obeys.
"If I didn't know you," Gilberto said, "I'd think you were a candidate for a psych ward."
"Sometimes lately, I've felt like one." Nick didn't know what he was doing. Or maybe he knew and couldn't stop himself, which makes me sick. She closed her eyes, took a deep breath. Suicides of successful, happy people have soared for 2 years. People with no history of depression, with every reason to live. Sometimes they take other people with them. She opened her eyes. "You must have seen the story about the woman in Minnesota, Teacher of the Year, not only killed herself, but also the governor and 40-some others. I know, for a fact, she was controlled by these people, as Nick was."
"You have proof of all this?"
"Yeah. So who do I trust with it? The FBI isn't entirely corrupt, but some people in it are part of this conspiracy. Same with the NSA, Homeland Security. They're salted everywhere."
"Go to the press?"
"I tried. Thought I had a trustworthy journalist. He wasn't. I have evidence, a lot of it. But if I give it to the wrong person and he destroys it, everything I've endured has been for nothing. And there's even worse than the Hamlet list, much worse. Not everyone they inject is programmed for suicide."
"Then what?"
"Some people under their control seem to have free will, but they don't. They're used ruthlessly, as programmed assassins. Others are flat out enslaved and used as cheap labor." She hated death, the thief that had robbed her of her mother and her husband. But when she looked at the corpse between her and the mortician, the cold,
wax-pale face suggested an enduring peace that might be envied by those who lived with a nano-web woven across and through their brains. I've seen men guarding an estate of one of the Arcadians, as they call themselves. A pack of men in slacks and sport coats, normal at first glance, but like trained dogs living in conditions as crowded as kennels. Their personalities and memories wiped away. No internal lives. Programmed to carry guns and provide security, to track down and kill intruders. They're like machines of flesh. If she had any doubt that he believed her, it was resolved when he made the sign of the cross. Machines of flesh, she repeated. There are high-end brothels for wealthy, powerful people who fund this conspiracy. I managed to get into one, and out alive. The girls are beautiful beyond words, but they have no memories. No awareness of who they once were, or of a world beyond the brothel. No hopes, no dreams, no interests except staying fit, desirable. Programmed to provide any sexual pleasure. Totally submissive, never disobedient. No desire is so extreme they won't satisfy it. They're soft-spoken, sweet, apparently happy, but it's all programmed. They're incapable of expressing anger, sadness. Somewhere deep inside? What if there is something left in one of them? Some palest shadow of real human feeling and awareness? Some thread of self-respect? Some fragile hope? Then her body is a prison, a life of unrelieved loneliness and a solitary hell. I've dreamed of being one of them. I wake up shaking as if with malaria. I'm not ashamed to say I'm terrified of ending like that, stripped of all free will. Because once the control mechanism assembles in the brain, there's no removing it, no way out, except death. 18. A dragon's egg moon emerged from a nest of shredding clouds harried southeast by a high wind that had no presence here at ground level. The oaks were widely separated now, each the majesty of its domain, black-limbed and cragged and crooked, like the scorched but stalwart survivors of a cataclysm, or oracles warning of some dire event impending. The land grew less hospitable to grass, and the last upslope was patterned with faint tree-cast moon shadows on a carpet of wet pebbles and scraggly clumps of flattened sedge. In spite of the inexplicable danger in which Tanuja and her brother found themselves, she could not help but see the story potential in this bizarre situation. Even as she hurried toward the crest of the last hill, a novel was germinating. A contemporary take on Hansel and Gretel, a brother and sister transported from the primeval woods of Germany to the semi-desert wildlands of Southern California, their adversary not a witch who lived in a house made of bread and cake, but instead some fearsome sect or wicked fellowship. What she had always liked most about Hansel and Gretel was that they kicked ass. After Gretel shoved the witch into the oven and bolted it shut, she and Hansel filled their pockets with the vicious hag's fortune of pearls and jewels. Gasping for breath, she and Sanjay reached the crest, where the source of the red, blue, and yellow auras that drew them through the darkness now flared bright below them. The sole structure in sight, a commercial building made to resemble a log house, advertised itself with a double row of neon tubes around the roofline. And in the enormous sign at the front, the words Coogan's Crossroads blazed within the glowing outline of a giant cowboy hat. At least 20 vehicles were parked in front of and beside the establishment. Faint country music found its way into the night from a barroom jukebox. Tanuja followed Sanjay down a slippery slope of rain-sodden, half-collapsed masses of foot-snaring areola grass and onto the east-west two-lane that made a crossroads with a north-south route. As they entered Coogan's parking lot, a few bars of Macarena by Los Del Rio issued from a pocket of Sanjay's jeans, bringing him to a halt. As the ringtone repeated, he fished out the smartphone that belonged to one of the men who had invaded their house. "Don't answer it," Tanuja warned. "I won't,"
Sanjay said. I took this so we'd eventually be able to get a lead on who they are.
Who's calling? What's their number?
No ID, Sanjay said. Although he did not accept the call, a connection was somehow affected. A long chain of binary code, like a centipede racing along